Welcome back to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I want to remind you, hopefully you know this, we put out a print magazine. It's called the Fretboard Journal. It's been going strong for 18 years, and it is unlike any guitar magazine you've ever seen. It's filled with things you can't find online, even in 2024. In-depth interviews with artists, beautiful photo essays, exhaustive histories on gear and luthery, and contributions from world-class photographers, writers, and creatives. It is crafted for guitar fanatics by guitar fanatics. We're selective about the ads that we run and who we partner with, and it is proof that print isn't dead. It just needed a reboot. Unplug with us by joining us at fretboardjournal.com. I'm your host, Jason Verlinde, the editor and founder of the aforementioned Fretboard Journal magazine, and every week on this show, I talked to someone I admire from the world of guitars. Thanks to everyone who wrote me a note about last week's episode with Craig Korth on how he overcame his focal dystonia through psychedelic therapy and so much more. It was quite a journey. That's one of the most special and candid conversations we've ever shared, and I'm glad it resonated with so many of you. Check it out if you haven't yet. And this week's guest is another incredible one, John Leventhal, the legendary producer and guitarist. He's amassed 6 Grammy Awards over the decades. He's collaborated with the likes of Jackson Browne, Willie Nelson, Dolly Parton, Sean Colvin, William Bell, and so many others, not to mention all the monumental work he's done with his wife and music partner, Roseanne Cash. John finally recently released his debut solo record. It's called Rumble Strip. I cannot recommend it enough. It's on all the streaming platforms. Like so many, this was the byproduct of the pandemic and the lockdown. And I'm so grateful that John had the time to do it. Please go check it out. During our chat, we talk about how Rumble Strip came to be, the gear that he used on it, tunings, and so much more. John has this incredible recording studio built within his home in New York City. That's where he recorded everything. You get to hear all about it. It's an inside point of view. It's super cool. We also talk briefly about a very special story running in the Fretboard Journal's 54th issue involving a vintage Martin guitar that belonged to John's father-in-law, Johnny Cash. Subscribers can look forward to that showing up in their mailbox soon. Like I said, join us if you haven't yet. You will love it. Schedules willing, I'm hoping we can also get John to our 2024 Fretboard Summit. That takes place August 23rd to 25th, 2024 at Chicago's Old Town School of Folk Music. Register for that at fretboardsummit.org. It is the guitar gathering of my dreams. I'd love to see you there. If John can't make it this year, he's got an open invite for 2025 and beyond. The Fretboard Journal podcast is brought to you by a handful of brands that we truly love. Peghead Nation, get your first month free or $20 off any annual subscription with the promo code Fretboard at checkout. Isotope is offering you all 10% off their software with the discount code FRET10 when you check out. Stringjoy Strings, also offering you 10% off of your first order at stringjoy.com. Just use the discount code Fretboard. StuMac is sponsoring our podcast now, the one-stop shop for all of your guitar tools, repair, and accessory needs. And last but not least, Mike and Mike's Guitar Bar here in Seattle, Washington, a true destination. You can also find them online, an incredible array of vintage gear at that store. And now, here is my talk with the legendary, multi-Grammy-winning John Leventhal. John, congrats. You did it.
Thanks, man. Took a while.
Yeah. I saw you, pre-pandemic at Crandall's shop, and I think you were hinting at the solo album back then. That was a while ago.
Oh, Lord, yeah. Well, I started probably thinking about it 2016-ish, you know, just the realization that, you know, I had all these, because I tend to co-write, you know, to a fair degree with the people I produce. And I have all these ideas that have never found a home, my orphans, as it were. So, you know, back in my mind, I'm like, God, what are you going to do with this? Well, Leventhal, you should probably, you know, stand up straight and try to make some sort of solo recording. Just, you know, but I would avoid it. You know, literally, I would do anything, raise children, make dinner, go to the grocery store, do anything, go on the road. And then when the pandemic hit, I really didn't have an excuse. So I just kind of dove in. It was great. It was a lucky me, right? I have a recording studio in my house. And so I had that to sort of console me during the first like 4 months or so, which were pretty weird, I think.
Were you compiling a folder of songs and sketches and things that might lend themselves to a solo album?
Well, the interesting thing was, the answer to that is yes. And I always thought that's basically what the solo record would be like. You know, the easy record industry version of it would have been easy. Well, the more obvious version would have been. Yeah, I mean, I have a considerable number of tracks of that I've written with various artists I produced that didn't make it to their records or any sort of bonus tracks. And, you know, occasionally I'll listen to them and I'll go, yeah, it's not bad. They're weird. You know, kind of, I kind of in retrospect understand why they didn't make it to the record, but I kind of like them, right? Because they're probably a little more Leventhal than they needed to be for the particular project. And so in the back of my mind, I was like, oh, well, that'll be an interesting record and da 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 da. But honestly, when the pandemic came and I sort of gave myself over to trying to feel creative and really open-minded about it, that kind of went by the wayside for the most part. There was at least one bit in there of the song that Mark Cohn and I had written for Dr. John, because I had mixed what became his last record. And I thought, oh, let's get a song on Dr. John's record, which never happened. Anyway, but the bottom line is, no, I found myself just sort of experimenting and doing stuff. And, you know, I love making music and I love recording. The big issue was, could I sort of make a statement that I wouldn't cringe at, basically? So, you know, it took a little while, a little serpentine, tried this, tried that, and it is what it is now. I see it as a kind of a baby step. You know, if I get some traction, I'll keep doing it because I liked it.
Yeah, I was wondering, you know, that the author Stephen Pressfield calls it like the resistance. I was wondering, like, what was the voice in your head that kept you all these years from trying this at least?
Well, you know, twofold. One is like the more esoteric existential, like, it might suck, right? So I didn't want to confront that. You know, it's like, you know, I've given this rap before, and then I'll come back to the rap. The second thing is obviously, you know, I'm not enamored of my own voice. Mm-hmm. I do sing a lot on records, but they're always in a kind of supportive background part, right? So the idea of like my voice being the focus is a little bit of a gauntlet for me to sort of accept and understand. So God, I lost the plot on the other thing. The thing about it not sucking. Yeah. You know, I have a pretty, you know, active internal critic, and, you know, they have served me well for the most part. So I just had to kind of navigate something that I thought had validity because I know how to make records. Right. So in some ways that's the easy part. Like it's a skill set I have for better or worse. So I'm capable of making something that sounds like a record, but I wasn't totally sure I was capable of making something that actually felt quote unquote meaningful to me, if that makes sense. So I don't know. I don't know if I did it, but you know, I liked the process and it was enjoyable to discover some stuff. And you know, there you go.
I mean, I'm always in awe of, you know, as a music journalist, music critic, like I don't know how any music journalists or critics or producers write any songs themselves, because we're all scrutinizing everything we're hearing and thinking about how it could be better. And then when it's our own work, it's like Mission Impossible.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely a lot easier when I write for or with other people. Well, it's like there's a focus that I have about that. And I have over the years, since I've been doing it so long, God, you know, I had to clock in. I've been doing it for, you know, producing and co-writing in kind of the real world, you know, for getting close to 40 years. So, you know, and over the years, I'm sure in the beginning I was fraught with all sorts of insecurity and anxiety, but as it's gone on, I feel kind of this weird, calm sense of confidence about when I know something's right for an artist. Now, obviously completely different ballgame when I am the artist, capital A, right? So that was definitely a hurdle I had to get over personally, yeah, to put myself in the spotlight.
So pandemic hits, you, like everybody, lockdown. Was there one, I'm guessing there had to be two songs where you're like, okay, these two dovetail nicely. This is the beginning of an album. I know you had dozens of songs to start with.
Absolutely. There was a moment, and it also opened the door to sort of jettisoning any preconceived ideas I had about what it was I was going to, supposed to, could do. I would say some point during the first 2 weeks of the pandemic, I just wrote this little piano piece, or it sort of felt like it wrote itself. But then again, that's a whole other conversation. A lot of stuff feels like it writes itself for me. I just wrote this little piano piece, and it kind of had this unresolved quality to it. And it felt like it captured something for me anyway. It was at night. First few weeks were pretty weird, right? In New York, Roseanne and I had got off the road. We had to cancel a bunch of gigs. We were out right smack in the middle of it as what seemed unimaginable became more and more imaginable. You know, flew home from like Montana, or I don't know where we were, Idaho, to an empty Kennedy Airport. Like, it was like a post-apocalyptic movie, really. We were like, oh my Lord. Get home, and we realize, okay, we're hunkering down just like everybody else. Like I say, lucky may have a studio. So what would I start doing every night? I would sort of just come down here and just go. And I wrote this piano thing kind of came, and it just sort of like, oh. Because I guess the other thing would be that people sort of perceive me as a guitar player. Like that's what I do.
You are.
And there's a perverse part of me where it's like, well, I'm not going to make a guitar record, right? So, and I just knew that this little piano thing was going to be the first thing on the record. I knew it. And then within a week after that, I wrote a series of hymns. I didn't set out to write a series of quote unquote hymns. I just started writing these things that felt hymn-like. I think I've always had like an affinity for a certain kind of hymn, both coming from like sort of the Anglican church and Black church and, you know, and all its various permutations, and even white, you know, Baptist church and all that. I mean, there's just something about a good hymn that's always gotten me, the chord changes, the, as I've said, the thing about, you know, they can look sorrow straight in the eye, but still leave you with some hope, which I think in some ways is kind of like always revolving around the way that I think and write and make records and stuff, not to get too highfalutin here. But I wrote this series of hymns, and particularly the one that I labeled number two. And I was like, oh, okay. This could be good. I still didn't know what the record was, but I thought, oh, they're my first two tracks. So that felt good. And it sort of gave me permission to then start experimenting, which I started to do.
So how many hymns are there? That was one of my
questions. There were three. I wrote a series of three in relatively like 2 days. I don't know why. Sometimes that'll happen to me. I just try to grab it, man. If it's there, I try to grab it. And I gave it, just so happened within a couple of weeks of me doing that, Rodney Crowell had decided to make a record, you know, as the way people were making them, you know, during the pandemic. And he asked me if I had any ideas, and I gave him the first one I wrote, which he then wrote, called it something else on his record, like Hymn 531. I can't remember the number.
Okay.
I think I just said, don't call it Hymn number one, because I might write another hymn number. Anyway, and I kept the other two and I put them on the record. So that's how that went down. And I knew they were solo guitar pieces, although I think I messed around with writing a string chart for one of them that I ended up not using.
Can you describe a little bit more in detail? You said that often these things just write themselves. I mean, has that always been the case for you? Or did you, you know, after years of routine and practice, kind of come upon some sort of writing technique that works?
Well, I mean, this is the conversation, right? How do you do it? Like, what happens? What's inspiration? What's effort? What's, you know, just showing up and going to work? I mean, it's all of them. I mean, I think, obviously, now I've been doing it. For some reason, I'll start at the beginning. When I first started playing guitar, the first time, when I first learned three chords, you know, probably in my case, I even remember it's like E, A, and D. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about other guitar players, but within right away, I was compelled to write a song with it. So hand in hand with me playing guitar was songwriting. So I've always written songs. Now I haven't always written good songs, you know, and it took a while, you know, but I've been writing songs for a long time, and the art of songwriting is fascinating. So it's all of those things. It's learning to recognize a decent idea when it flies by, and then to pay attention to it and try to grab it. And those do feel like they write themselves. They do. And they're exciting and it's exhilarating. And the thrill of it is exactly the same now as it was 30 years ago, 40 years ago, for me anyway. And that'll often come about with me being unconscious. You know, as the classic case, I'll just have a guitar in hand and I'll make a mistake and I'll be like, whoa, what is that mistake? And the mistake becomes the idea, or at least the beginning of an idea. But having said that, since I kind of consider it my quote unquote job, yeah, I mean, there are times where I'll work at it, right? Like I'll think about, particularly when I'm co-writing for someone where there's kind of a destination. Mm-hmm. So I don't always write with a destination. I just write, right? I mean, I'm sure I'm just like a lot of other people. I just write and I just try to write. And then hopefully there's some winnowing or process where you harvest what you consider the decent ones or the good ones or the compelling ones. But there are definitely times where, you know, I've had to slog it out, you know. I mean, I guess if I had to really think about it, the ones that don't get slogged out are probably ends up being the ones that are my more of my favorites. But there have definitely been songs where I've had to work at it, you know, like to find it. Like I kind of feel there's a good idea there. And it's either you got to really work hard on the music, on completing the idea of the music, as opposed to like a section of the music. Because when you're writing songs, particularly in my case, I'm also sort of thinking of making a record. So a lot of times they go hand in hand, which is not always the case. Sometimes a song just stands on its own. But particularly songs where I feel like, oh, this is going to be a good record, sort of the dance of trying to conceive of the final record and the arrangement becomes part of the songwriting. Anyway, that's a lot of verbiage about, I do it all different ways, basically. There isn't a way that I haven't done it. There isn't a way I haven't written a song. I've written a song with guitar, piano, playing bass, sitting at the drums, walking down the street. It's all good, yeah.
But you said at one point the word unconscious, which makes me then ask you, are you trying to not think about anything when you're sitting there with guitar? Is it like a meditation practice?
Yes, absolutely. And this goes for playing on records too, for me. As time
turning everything out.
Well, for my part of it for me is willing to let go of this internal critic, I said, of my internal record producer, my internal arranger. They take a break for the first hour or so. And really trying to connect with, once again, this is going to sound kind of highfalutin, but when I've thought about it, I do think this is what's happening. It's really trying to connect on some other level, visceral, emotional, some other level to the moment that's happening musically, particularly when I'm playing, right? If I'm playing, I really, at least initially, try not to think. I really try to just connect with the music, let all the stuff that's been stored up inside me, both with my hands and my brain and my heart, just do their job without me controlling it. And inevitably, not 100% of the time, inevitably there'll be some foundational, decent ideas there. And it's the same with songwriting. A lot of times, in fact, making this record, I can get too analytical too quickly with songwriting. I can think about it too much, as opposed to just giving yourself over to the visceral experience of creating a little composition in a short period of time and going with it. So like the title track in this record is, I don't consider that I wrote it. I just came down one night, poured myself a whiskey, and full disclosure, had a hit of weed. And just with the idea that I felt good. And I just know that sometimes if there's a blank canvas and I pick up a guitar, something will happen. And once again, lucky me, I have a recording studio and it's always wired. I never have to patch bay anything. It's like I have acoustic guitar chains, electric guitar chains, drums, bass. They're all ready to go like that, which is the way I wanted it when we built it. Because I discovered, not to get too sidetracked here, I discovered, you know, over the years of doing it, like there'd be along these lines of being unconscious, being immediately, responding viscerally. You know, if I was in a real recording studio with an engineer, I'd be like, oh, I want to do this. And then 10 minutes later, when everything's patched and the sounds are there, I'd want to do it. So the bottom line is, yes, I do try to stay unconscious, and it's a great feeling and it's a great experience. And I do write songs that way as well. Was that kind of long-winded? But I think I was trying to cover a lot of ground there.
You covered tons of ground. This is amazing. Right. And going to the production of the record, you know, you covered all of your styles. There's acoustic, I don't know exactly, we can get into, because I think Fretboard Journal people want to know all the instruments. We can get into that in a minute. But your finger picking, your flat picking, your electric playing, obviously your singing, it's all there. Was that a preconceived notion, or did that just kind of happen naturally too?
I think it happened naturally, but probably there was a little bit of thought about what to do about the guitar player. Yeah. 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 What are we going to do with this fucking guitar player? Yeah. 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 Because I don't really give voice to the full expressiveness of my guitar playing as a producer. I mean, there's little moments here and there, and they're all in service of the artist and the song I'm working with. That's always the foundation. I mean, that's always completely and totally primary. So what do we do with the guitar player when he's like the focus, right? You know, and I experimented. Like, there were some, because I've been playing Telecaster since I was a kid, and, you know, and I love that tradition, you know, that language that's been developed on it. You know, it was kind of really foundational for me in a lot of ways, you know. And, you know, so I wrote and played a couple of what I think people go, oh, cool, Tele, you know, kind of a cool Tele instrumental. And at the end of the day, I just felt like, why are you doing that, man? It's like, there's a million other people who do that, and they do it just as well. I don't know. Maybe on the next record. That didn't feel right for this for me. Mm-hmm. I can't explain it. So did I think about all this stuff you're saying, like to care, like to have versions of these little stylistic things I've developed? Not super consciously, but not totally unconsciously. I knew I wanted some solo guitar pieces, which end up, you know, for the most part being, you know, I play with my fingers, not with a pick.
Yeah.
I knew at least one or two things where I could just kind of play some solos on electric guitar. So that's a thing. So yeah, I guess I had a little bit of that. I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, there's this emotional gravity and lyricism to everything on this, even the guitar instrumentals.
Thanks, which, man.
Is there one track that is the most John Leventhal when you're at home with your callings, just playing by yourself on the couch?
Well, you know, I have no idea. You'd have to tell me. I'm like the worst John. I'm not a good John Leventhal whisperer. I don't know. I'm still discovering who John Leventhal is, to be honest. I don't know, man. I mean, the song that people seem to be responding to as sort of the what's the right way of saying this? Like the most emotional expression of whatever it is I do on the guitar is this thing, Hymn Number 2, right?
Yeah.
There's I think that's probably twofold. There's a compositional element to it. It's pretty. And, you know, I don't know if I've talked to you about it. I feel like I talked about it on a regular basis. You know, I play a lot in this tuning where I drop the E string down to a C and the A string down to a G, and the other four strings stay standard. And I've kind of developed a vocabulary in that tuning that feels kind of like me, like, that feels like, well, that's as much of an expression of who I am as anything I do, if that makes sense. And Hymn Number 2 sort of seems like it has all of that, like the voicings that tuning lends you, you know, hammer-ons and pull-offs that I think stylistically people may associate with my touch or whatever. But does that make sense, I guess?
Yeah, what is that tuning called? Does it have a name?
I don't know what the name of it is. I should have a name for it. I'll make up my own name. I don't know. I mean, it's just, it's not, I didn't invent it. I came at it slightly circuitously, although it is used, you know, I think it's what the cats in Hawaii use. So clearly Rye had used it. I mean, we can talk about Rye too, because to me, Hymn Number 2 is influenced by Rye. Now, if I've done my job right, it doesn't overtly sound like Rye, but I know in my heart that there's, and it's not just the guitar playing, there's a certain poetry that Rye has that I think has influenced me as much as anything. Anyway, so I don't know what the name of the tuning is. It's just, I just call it drop C tuning. And, you know, man, it's, I should have one in here with that tuning, but I'd have to find it. So let's see. Is that doesn't make sense to get the guitar.
It's fine.
Yeah. But I love it. And I feel very fluid in it. I really started getting into it on, I had always used it a little bit, but mostly as a tool in the studio. And then I made a record with Sean Colvin in like 1997 called A Few Small Repairs. And we co-wrote most of the tunes, and I started writing in that tuning a lot on that record. And it really kind of opened my mind and my musical heart. It's like, oh, there's something here. I like this. And then I just started using it more and more and more. So now I play in that tuning all the time, like live with Roseanne, and I've gotten more expressive with it, or more comfortable with the possibilities of the voicings and the weird tunings. So it just feels more natural to me now. So
acoustic and electric for that tuning, or
yeah,
just acoustic?
Yeah, yeah. Although I'd say, yeah, mostly acoustic, but definitely on electric. Yeah, there's a tune on that Sean Colvin record that guitar players always seem interested in called Get Out of This House, that's in that tuning. But yeah, I definitely do it on electric for sure.
Yeah.
And I know that Rye's used it too. You know, I couldn't tell you exactly what tune, but there you go.
Yeah. You cover, or you interpret the Copland, the clarinet concerto.
Yeah.
And I listened to the track you did and was thoroughly moved by it. And then I'll confess, I went back and had to, you know, maybe I'd heard that. Maybe that was in my synapses, but I hadn't heard in a while. So I went back to listen to the original, at least the Benny Goodman version.
That's the one, man. That is the one. Yeah.
And I was thoroughly moved by that one too, and thought, like, how the heck did John think this would make a great guitar composition?
Well, there you go. That's an insight into my little weird mind for sure.
You know, Jason,
let me see what to say about that. This will circle back to your questions about, well, what were you thinking about when you made the record and this, that, the other thing? Mm-hmm. And that kind of idea was the kind of idea that would come up when I had to let go of all my preconceived notions. Like, I would have not thought about that pre-pandemic as a good idea. But this kind of, to me, you know, circulates in this idea of creativity and being unconscious and being open to ideas and kind of learning how to recognize a halfway decent idea of when to really go for it and, you know, when to think it's gimmicky or whatever it could be or whatever. So I was just looking for inspiration, and I'm sure, you know, I listen to orchestral music, you know, on a regular basis, as in fact, and a lot of, not just like quote unquote classical composers. I mean, I don't even think of Copland as necessarily a classical composer. You know, there's a lot of film composers. Bernard Herrmann is one who I cover as well, and really love Thomas Newman, like concurrent guys, or not everything, but there are moments, you know, man, it's just like, I'm just like anybody else. If there's something I hear, even in that music, as opposed to like the Beatles or Motown or, you know, whatever, you know, like I'll just kind of perk my head and pay attention to it. And luckily, you know, my ears are big enough that I can kind of, you know, if I put my mind to it, I can kind of suss it out. And that's what I did with Copland's thing. I was like, God, I love this piece of music. But the truth is, I don't know what the harmony is. Like, so that's where it started. It didn't start where, oh, I'm going to do this like Duane Eddy. It just started with, oh, I really love this. You know, isn't it time I learned what all the strings are doing? And so I did that, and I'm using my guitar in the C tuning because the clarinet concerto starts in C, mm-hmm, conveniently, with that low C below, that C below middle C. And I was like, oh man, it just sits in this tuning. Look at this. Because they're kind of root fifth, third spread voicings, very wide voicings, which sound beautiful in strings and also sounds beautiful on guitar. I was just, oh, look at that. I can kind of play the string part. Oh, man, I could play this melody on guitar. Yeah,
with a Bigsby. Oh, it'd be beautiful. Yeah, put a little reverb on it and be like my mind doesn't overtly think of this, but then I realize like, oh yeah, this is like a Dwayne Eddy, like beautiful Hank Marvin, Dwayne Eddy thing that I've always loved that stuff, man. I love, you know, the language of guitar and guitar culture. I'm just not interested in regurgitating anything stylistically that people have done better in the past. That's never made any sense to me. I mean, a lot of guitar players do that. To me, the trick is, how do you take an idea like Dwayne Eddy and Bigsby and reverb and a beautiful, simple melody and, you know, mess with it and turn it on its head? Well, yeah, play Aaron Copland's clarinet concerto. So there you go. I mean, that's sort of the way my mind works, to sort of, yeah.
Well, you're bringing up Bigsby's and gears, so we might as well go into that chapter of the conversation. What guitars primarily are on this record, or are there a whole bunch?
Oh, God, I should do a much better job of, like, notating this. I don't, because I do, in the same way, all this other stuff, I'll pick a guitar very spontaneously. And lucky me, I have a bunch of guitars now. I didn't when I started, but I do now.
When you say you didn't when you started, you mean your career or this record?
Oh, no. No, I had them luckily when I started the record.
Okay.
Yeah, they're definitely my one material vice. I don't care about cars or clothes or anything. Okay, what did I use? It will help me if you ask me a specific tune and then I can kind of focus.
Oh, man. Well,
hymn number two, I happen to know because I've had to play that a bunch. So I have I've always had a fondness for Gibson Jumbos and all their permutations, you know, mm-hmm. J35s, SJs, and, you know, J50s, J45s. So, you know, I have a great J35 from the 30s and a great SJ from the 40s and a great J50 from the 50s. They all sound different, but I love them and they all record really well. They all have really great, what I call fundamental tone. Microphones seem to really like them. They find their place in a track. They're very easy. It took me a while to sort of like get that all. Like, oh, what guitars really record well? And, you know, on top of sounds that are pleasing to me. Anyway, I also have a 1949 J50. Mm-hmm. And it's really what I would call very dried out. It's incredibly light, really beat up. And it's a particularly what I would call dry, just feels dried out. The wood feels dried out. And sonically, it's dried up. So that's what I used. And I recorded, you know, I tried recording it just the way you would normally do. And it was nice, but I thought, oh, it just needs something a little different. So I put an old DeArmond. You know, remember the old, or from the 60s, those DeArmond acoustic guitar pickups, those big things. So I put one in there and I just put that through a Princeton reverb with a little bit of tremolo and just mixed that amp signal a little bit behind a traditionally recorded acoustic guitar. And that's the sound of that one.
Do you have I'm looking at your studio now on Zoom. Do you have like a little amp isolation room?
I have, yes. I have, lucky me, so I have 1,000 square feet. Pretty good. Oh, wow. So, yeah, Roseanne and I bought a townhouse in 95 or 96, around there. So we've been here for a while. And I won't go into the hall. So we have a ground floor, which we've never really needed. So I had a friend living down here for a while, and my daughter lived down here for a while. And I had a studio in various spaces in Manhattan for a while. In about 2015-16, our ground floor was empty and the lease came up on the studio space we had. And my partner and I decided what we're going to pay here for rent for a year, we could build a studio. Mm-hmm. It was the best thing I ever did. I can't believe I didn't do it 25 years ago. Idiot. I thought I needed to go somewhere to work. Didn't. Mm-hmm. Love having the studio in the house. Anyway, so yeah, I have a control room where I'm sitting now, where you're looking at me, and this way is a live room. It's a room within a room, floated room. It's got drums, bass amp, B3, piano, Whirly, all my guitar amps. And so that's actually quite isolated.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have like another room in the front my sister will use, and mic, you know, I have wooden hallways that sound pretty good, and they're all mic'd up. So it's great. It's great. I have a backyard this way, so that's nice.
Amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. Yeah, I'm a lucky man for sure.
since you had almost a lifetime of being in recording studios before you built your own, was this inspired by one or two studios in particular in the layout and everything?
That's a good question. My buddy Rick, who sadly passed away before the pandemic, really designed it. He was an autodidact of the first order. He just dove into studio design. There was no specific space because it's the other way around in some ways. The space dictates what it's going to be, right? So I don't actually have tall ceilings. That's the one downside. Although it hasn't, you know, I think the records I make here sound pretty good. So it's more the space really dictated what we could do. The one major thing was this kind of workflow idea that I mentioned to you, which was we had enough gear that I knew on the way that I use the studio 80% of the time, if not more, we had enough gear that everything is ready to go. When I say everything, I mean everything. I have like a little vocal booth area. It's always ready to go. I have two acoustic guitar mics, always ready to go. Drums are always ready to go. B3 is always ready to go. Bass is always ready to go. Every signal chain is ready to go. And I don't, for the most part, so always little moments where we want to try something else. For the most part, I'm ready to go like that. So, and that was the one thing I kept saying over and over. It's like, no. I want it hardwired to go. So it is.
Super cool.
Yeah.
You said it's been around for like 8 years, or you started 8 or 9 years ago. Obviously there was a pandemic there in the middle of that. Have you brought in other artists or other artists coming to use your studio that you're producing?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Like I did, Roseanne's. I did a William Bell record here in 2016. That was one of my personal favorites. Did well, or at least won a Grammy. Did a record with Sarah Jarosz here.
Yeah, those all took place there. Okay.
Yeah, and that won a Grammy too. Yeah, so it's good sonically. I really like my space a lot. I mean, sounds like my space. Doesn't sound like anybody else's records. I mean, this is another esoteric conversation. I kind of stopped critically listening to other people's records to understand what they sound like a while ago. And I think I make better records. I try to keep an open mind and heart of listening to new music, but I don't get bogged down in what's currently happening, you know, and that might have to change. I don't know that, you know, I've had a good run without doing that. I started that in about 2010. I just started ignoring everyone and everything. And I think I started making better records, but,
like ignoring the production or,
or
just turning out music.
Oh, man, I don't even know if I want to go down this road. You got to understand, I started doing this around 1986, 1987, yeah. Right? I mean, and even before that, I was sort of producing other demos for people, you know. The thing that clicked for me in the kind of, you know, real music world was this Sean Colvin record I did called Steady On. You know, so now that's like 36, 30, whatever that is. I have to do the math. Yeah, more, 37 years ago or something like that. Yeah. And, you know, so I've been doing this for a while. And when I first started, you know, there was quite a bit of pressure to create hits, dare I say. And it was a completely different business. I mean, the record business was just totally different. Like what was prioritized, what were people interested, what you could get a record company interested in promoting was different. Everything was different than it is now. So, yeah, at some point, I just realized, why am I listening to anybody at a record company? You know, I also just started being like, I realized that, you know, I've been doing this longer than anybody working at any record company. So, I don't know. I just started making better records. I just felt liberated. I felt liberated to trust my instincts. And I started engineering and mixing my records. I just kind of like took a little bit of a turn in the road. I felt like I'd been going down this one way of trying, and this I'm saying with the, it's not black and white, it's not, but I felt like I'd been trying to like navigate a path of a very big juggernaut called the record business.
Sure.
And at some point, I just decided not to navigate it. And luckily, I got to keep making records. And it worked out for me artistically. It just worked out better. That's all. That's all I have to say about that. I think I made better records. Probably haven't sold as much, but they've won more Grammys and been better received. And what's even more important is that I like them better. So there you go.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even, you're not even an outlier, but there are folks like yourself and Joe Henry who have made records that have, you know, I think truly stood the test of time, whereas some bigger budget records maybe haven't.
Yeah. 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 I mean, and I think guys like Joe and I get to do it because of this kind of swing that happened in the record business. A way there's like, you could sort of make records and not have hits or whatever, you know, whatever. I don't know, man. This is to me a really interesting conversation, but it's not maybe necessarily fretboard journalish. I don't know
what, but what is, who's to say?
I don't know.
Is.
We're finding out. Let's push the,
well, let's, all right, let's swing the pendulum the other way. I don't want to start a Cola Wars version two here, but you just mentioned a bunch of vintage Gibsons that you said sounded great on recording. Do you think, generally speaking, Gibsons, vintage Gibsons at least, record better or more evocative than like an old Martin?
I would never say better, more evocative. And it depends, you know, on one level, like all of us, I'm enamored of guitars and everything about them, particularly vintage guitars.
Yeah.
But on another level, for a guy like me anyway, they're also tools. So, right, it's like picking the right tool. So, I mean, you know, I love Martin guitars too. I mean, I do think D28s and D18s, for me, since I'm not a flat picker, those two have always been a little, it's taken me a long time to find a D18 and D28 that I liked.
Sure.
I think I finally have. They were harder for me to find. I don't use them as much on recordings. Do I love playing them? Yeah. Do I pick them up and play them and pretend I'm a flat picker sometimes? Yeah. Or even other stuff. Yeah. But for what I do, for whatever, this is just me and nothing else but me. Yeah. There's a kind of little heart connection with these Gibson things. And I have a great L00. I have actually two great L00s. Yeah. There's just something, what would I say? It's hard to find words for these things. They kind of read a little woodier to me. Mm-hmm. And they're also, I can talk about this idea of fundamental tone, in which they're, you know, certain guitars can sound really complex. And that can be a beautiful thing, particularly a guitar by itself with a player who knows how to utilize the complexity of the guitar and the overtones and make some really beautiful stuff happen. Just my aesthetic and the way that I end up using acoustic guitars, for the most part, there's always exceptions, I like a little bit of an uncluttered sound and less, more fundamental tone, less overtones, more like that the essence of the guitar, the woodiness comes out into the microphone and sits perfectly. And there's a kind of evenness where the trebles have a certain thickness and the bass has a certain thickness, but neither one is louder or the other. I mean, I could talk about this a lot because obviously I've thought of Gibson's, vintage Gibson's. Okay, let's say pre, you know, adjustable bridge or even the adjustable bridge. I had one. I gave it to my son, Jake. It sounded like a Donovan record, which I always liked. You know, so some of these things are just little quirks that I have for records that I loved growing up, right? They represent that sound. Or James Taylor's first record with his J50, which I still think that's a great guitar sound, right? Very dry, very thuddy. Anyway, so I have a little bit of thing about it. But having said that, man, you know, I have a killer 00021. I'm terrible with dates. I know it's definitely post-war, you know, it's like whatever, 46, 47, 48, somewhere in there. It's killer. It's great. It's beautiful, beautiful guitar. I didn't use it on the record, but I do love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gibsons tend to be a little quirkier in that there's a wide array of, you know, one model from one year could sound completely different. Has there been a lot of trial and error to get to the ones that are sitting there with you in the studio?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah, it's like one out of 20 for me at best, if not more. Yeah, to find them.
you know, luckily or unluckily for me, all the guitar dealers, they got my name in their Rolodex, man. So, you know, and I sort of discovered them through the J35, oddly enough. So I just happened to get this great J35. I think it's hanging on the wall over there somewhere. Yeah. I think it's like a 39. A long time, like that was the first one I got. And I was like, God damn, I love this guitar. It was incredible. Yeah. And that sort of led me down the road to finding good versions of the other ones. Hey, I should say as a side note, I also have a slight thing for small bodied Guilds from the 60s, early 60s in particular.
Okay.
That was another thing. I have a really good F30 and a really good F20. And they record really well too. And those are almost impossible to find that are good because really you'll play 30 of them and they'll just be terrible. And the 31st is really extraordinary.
Figured out why the 31st is so much better than the other?
No. And I've even talked to Tom Crandall about it. It's very, very focused. Very focused.
Yeah. Zoom's doing the thing where it compresses and makes it sound awful, but
I believe you. God, sorry about that. You're right, he's halfway decent mic. All right, sorry about that. Anyway, the bottom line is, I don't know, man. It's kind of endless. I have to kind of watch myself.
What? We could, but we don't need to go track by track on this because I know you've done that. I've poking around. I've seen you go track by track with, you know, in some other interviews. But one composition that I want to hear you riff on a little bit is the Goodbye to All That, because there's an emotion you bring out of that guitar, which I think probably has to do with your production expertise, mic placement. I don't know, like what magic went on? What magic do you do as a producer who's like an acoustic guitar nerd that maybe us mortals wouldn't know?
Well, God, I mean, it's very tempting to say there is no magic.
Okay.
I mean, it is, but I'm going to get all, I mean, I'll tell you exactly what I do. Although I do tend to think there's a little weird, if the magic is happening, it's not about mics and mic pre's and compressors and signal chains. It's learning how to play in a recording environment, which is definitely different than playing on your own in the living room and definitely different than playing live. For the most part, there is a nexus where that can all sort of meet. And sometimes it's the engineer / producer's job to capture somebody's spontaneous performance who maybe isn't super studio savvy or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I have a certain signal chain I use. If there's any little bit of magic, it's the judicious use of compression. It's sort of just getting a sensibility of how much to compress, when, you know, and how much, because you don't want to hear the compression, but compression is a really powerful tool for making your guitar sound solid and move towards you, right? Now, there are times where I try not to use compression too, but in a general sense, I have a feeling when people have talked to me about, oh, your guitar sound here or there, I think a lot of it has to do with a judicious use of compression. Now, I have a bunch of compressors. I will say I am extremely fond of distressors, and you know, they're made by Empirical Labs. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They've been around forever. I bought them right in the beginning. I still have, they're shocked because they treat me very well that I got them right away, because they were a better, in my mind, a much better version of an 1176. Now I'm talking compression here. I don't know. Mm-hmm. This is the recording engineer part of me. But I do really, really love distressors. For me, they have a clarity. I really love the way they compress because it's not super noticeable, but they solidify your sound a little bit. And then after that, if there's anything, I think on that song you're referring to, I'll do little weird things along the lines of, boy, I'm giving you all my secrets there, Jason. Along the lines of Hymn Number 2, where I probably had a pickup in the guitar. I have a bunch of different weird pickups that I can throw in an acoustic guitar that are not
you know, permanently installed that I can experiment with different guitars from different eras, from the 60s, 70s, 80s. And I think on that track, if memory serves, I hope I'm right about this, I think I also have a Leslie. And I think I put a tiny bit of the acoustic guitar through the Leslie. Everything sounds good through a Leslie, man, I've discovered. Now, even if you don't feature the Leslie, if you just, like I say, sometimes I'll take a separate signal from your traditional acoustic guitar, beautiful recorded acoustic guitar sound, and just sonically mess with it. Never to the point of, I'm not trying to be gimmicky for the most part, but it's just a way to bring the magic, as it were, I guess. I don't know, something like that. So I don't know. Is that helpful or?
That was super helpful. Are you doing all this by yourself? Do you have a helper when you're like in the mode of I'm going to make a record?
I can do it all by myself. I do have a great assistant. His name is Mark Goodell. So when we have a bunch of players here, yeah, I need him. If I'm playing particularly, or even sometimes when I'm not playing, just so I can focus on it. But on my record, I played everything, you know? So yeah, it's like I say, I built the studio in some ways for this in mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a variety of microphones for acoustic instruments?
I do have a variety, although I do, there's a microphone that I don't think a lot of other people use that I use 90% of the time. Yeah.
Are you going to tell us that or no?
I am going to tell you. It's a Gefell UMT-70S.
Okay.
And once again, I like a lot of this stuff. I've discovered I've had four of them and they all sound a little bit different. I don't have a match pair, but that doesn't bother me. But I have two unbelievably great Neumann U67s, large diaphragm. So if you look at some pictures of Beatle records, like you'd see in front of John's acoustic guitar, a 67. So it depends, you know, it sort of depends. But these Gefell UM, there's two that just are literally on a swivel. And I'm showing it to them. They're like literally here all the time.
You're not kidding. It's all wired.
I could have played something for you and like, God, oh, that's really good. Okay, excuse me, Jason. And I'm going to go record it, right? So that's how quick I like to do it. So, yeah, I mean, they're good. But like I say, you know, I could put other mics on it and I don't think it would sound radically different than these Gefells. There's something about that I always feel like I'm forcing the sound into the microphone somehow. I don't know.
Okay. Do you write out all your music too, or is it just
no. I mean I could, but and I mean I have, but not as a matter of course, no. Mm-hmm.
So now that Rumble Strip is out, like, have the floodgates been opened and we can look forward to more John Leventhal recordings?
Man, I'm trying to, you know, it's been an uphill battle promoting it. So I'm glad you're talking to me about it. It's not, you know, it's not an obviously easy marketing journey I'm discovering. But, you know, I feel like it's gaining a little bit of something or another. Yeah, man, I would love to do it again. I would love to do it again. And I would love to do something completely different. I've already started thinking about what that would be, like something really different. I'm not totally sure yet. Yeah, maybe go back to that original idea of co-writing with a bunch of different people and seeing what happens, you know? I don't know. Maybe.
Have you played these songs out in a live setting?
A little bit, not too many of them. We do this song. You know, because, you know, I'll go out and my wife and I have a kind of act.
An act. You know, you know, an understatement of a century.
Yeah, we have an act. So, you know, like, you know, it's a little bit of our bread and butter is just the two of us to go out. We also have a band. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she and I go out and do a bunch of shows every year. And we'll do this song we wrote together called That's All I Know About Arkansas. You know, I'll play one or two of the hymns. I haven't gotten too deep into everything else. Honestly, I mean, I could play the solo guitar pieces, I guess, but you know, it's interesting. It's really ultimately Roseanne's gig. I mean, we kind of, it's billed the two of us, but it's really her gig. And it's kind of, we tried doing some of me playing these solo guitar pieces and it always felt like, you know, the energy's kind of drifting a little bit here. So I don't know. Yeah, it's weird. I don't know. I've thought about, needless to say, like my publicist, like a record company, Elliot, you know, whatever, they're all like, are you going to gig? Are you going to play some tunes? The idea of me going out by myself is like, oh God, no. I've thought about getting a little trio together, but I also know myself well enough to know the minute I'd started rehearsing with them, I'd be bored with playing the tunes on my record. So this is going to dovetail on what my next record might be. It might be completely different. Right. There's two musicians I would love to try as a trio here in New York. Sean Pelton and his bass player, Andy Hess. They don't know it yet. They're going to find out soon. And just sort of see what would happen with me as the guitar player. So I don't know. It might happen. Yeah.
So switching gears a minute. In our next issue, we have a pretty special story about a 1940 Martin, going back to Martin now, D18.
Cool.
You want to tell us about it?
Well, yeah. When I turned 50, it was over 20 years ago, or I guess I started thinking about it a year ago or whenever. I forgot when I wrote you. Probably like a year ago, right? Mm-hmm. My father-in-law... one day I was home and the UPS guy came with a huge fiberglass road case. No package, no box, no anything. I was like, what the heck is this? And it was like, there was a label on it. It was addressed to me. I'm like, and I opened it up and it was a D18. I wasn't totally sure it was pre-war D18 at that point, but it became clear to me pretty quickly. I was like, what? And it was my father-in-law, Johnny Cash, had sent me his 1939 D18 as a 50th birthday present. How nice was that? Pretty surprising, pretty great. And he sent it with a beautiful letter, basically saying, hey, want you to have this, use it. And when you can't use it anymore, give it to his grandson, my son, Jake. So how sweet was that? Mm-hmm. Anyway, cut 20 years later, you know, I don't play it that much. There were some things about it. It really was in need of some TLC, right? It needed the neck set. It needed to be refretted. It needed some stuff. Probably needed a new bridge plate. It was kind of tight and stiff, and I didn't feel like it was that great a guitar. Loved having it. Anyway, I thought, God, what am I doing? I should probably get all this work done on this guitar. And then I had my little aha moment. It's like, oh, well, why don't we document the work? My friend Tom Crannell, great luthier that you know here in New York. I went to him, I said, hey, Tom, how do you feel about like doing all this work on this guitar, and let's document it, you know, and let's take some pictures. It'll be good for my family, be good for my kids, you know, grandkids, maybe ultimately, you know, just, I thought, oh, this would be worth documenting. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm glad we did. So we did it. Tom did it, made it a much better guitar. We took pictures. I asked you whether you'd be interested in running a story about it.
Yes.
Thankfully, you were open to it. And I can't wait to see it, man. I haven't seen it. So
it's, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I should also say Tom wrote a beautiful essay, I thought, about a very poetic essay about a wide range of stuff that has to do with guitars and music and pre-war Martins and family, and like it's nice. It's really good.
Yeah, he's got a lot. He's a pretty talented guy on a couple fronts, it turns out.
He's a soulful dude for sure.
Yeah. Well, I can't thank you enough for on, you know, letting us do that, chronicle that. It's going to be beautiful. I've seen the early versions. It's already looking very beautiful. So, and thanks for your time, John. It's been amazing to get to know you over the last few years.
Yeah, Jason, thank you for being part of the journey. I truly appreciate it. And, you know, the magazine's great, and good luck. And I can't wait to get my next issue.
All right, that was my chat with John. I hope you enjoyed it. Next week, we have another great guest lined up, Josh Scott, founder of JHS Pedals. We're not going to be talking about pedals and his pedal empire as much as we're going to be talking about guitar media in 2024. It's a fascinating chat. You're going to want to tune in. Subscribe to the podcast over on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you tune in, and stay tuned.